All right. So the public report section of the police review board, that is 320-140I, and it's page 8. So it's the back of 320. So it's page 8. The public reports shall include allegations heard by the board, a factual summary of the case, summary of the board's discussion, record of the board's vote, including recommended findings and disciplines, training and policy recommendations, including whether the recommendations were followed by the chief, and the chief's proposed and final discipline for the involved officers.
Mr. Director,
yes,
just a point of clarification. If there is a significant disagreement among the voting members, would the non-prevailing side have the opportunity to put a minority report in?
Is that
permitted or is that discretionary?
I mean, the way it works right now is the facilitator writes the report. So there isn't a majority report or the minority report. The way the police review board works, it's not really, it's the recommendations to the chief, who's the final decision maker. So the chief gets all that information. So let's say it's a normal case, there are five voting members, two voted for sustained, two voted not to sustain, and one person just didn't know what to do. So the two who voted to sustain, they would get discipline they would make discipline recommendations, and that would be reflected in the report as well. So all the different votes would be reflected in the facilitator's report to the chief, and that's what it ends up being in a modified version, the public reports.
So that would include then a specific recital of the reasons why people voted against the recommended action.
From this would not require that. From what I've seen in the past, it's just a recital of the vote count, and you know, sometimes there is that longer recitation, but there, you know, these are relatively brief reports. It doesn't go into extreme amount of detail.
I guess the point I want to make is I don't want to preclude something being raised by someone who dissents from the prevailing vote that might inform future discussions about policy changes or procedural or substantive.
Okay.
And sometimes, as we know from Supreme Court decisions, it's the dissenting decision that often offers the most value in the future. And I would hope that there's a way of encouraging some explanation of dissenting votes if it raises a substantive issue that we would want, that the chief and the council would want to know about.
I can do that. Thank you. So for officer-involved shootings and custody deaths, this is coming from also community feedback and just from my experience of reviewing these cases and our office's experience reviewing these cases. The public reports are an opportunity to educate members of the public on the level of investigation that every officer-involved shooting in custody death receives. There's the detective's investigation, the internal affairs investigation, the training analysis, and there's a lot that the Portland Police Bureau puts into every one of these officer-involved shootings. It doesn't take a complaint, so to speak, for a case to be opened in officer-involved shooting in custody death. I don't think the public as a whole understands how much work that the city puts into these cases, and I think the public reports are a good way to do that. Additionally, by the time the public reports are made public, which is two times a year, a lot of the information has been made public in different formats, and there isn't one place that kind of encapsulates the whole case. So I think the public reports would be a good place for that to happen. So in cases of officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths, the public report shall contain the names of involved officers and witnesses unless confidentiality or non-disclosure is required by law, a court order, administrative order, or a collective bargaining agreement, or unless the police commissioner believes confidentiality is required or appropriate due to a collective bargaining agreement or by a pending criminal or civil legal proceeding. So this is in, you know, each one of these cases is different, and there might be a very good reason why this information should be made public. That would rest with the police commissioner as the person in charge of the Portland Police Bureau. And that is the end of my presentation. If there are any questions, we can just let members of the public who have waited long enough to get up here.
Well, just a question of procedure. Are we going to have a Are we going to have testimony from the police chief before we take public testimony?
Yes, we're going to hear from the panel, and then we're going to hear from the chief and Captain Famous, and then we're going to take public testimony.
I'd just say, from my point of view, it's going to be helpful to have them frame whatever disagreements they have for us rather than ask you these questions prematurely. I'd like to have
okay.
It would be helpful for me to have the disagreements framed.
Yeah. The auditor's got a panel she wants to bring forward next, and then after that I'll ask the chief and Captain Famous to come up. So
Michael Alexander, Jan Friedman, and Casey Jama, please.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Who's on first?
Alphabetical order, maybe.
All right.
Yeah, well, good afternoon. My name is Michael Alexander, and I am the executive director of the Urban League of Portland. And I'm here today to offer testimony on behalf of the Urban League in support of the majority of the proposed reforms to police accountability recommended by the city auditor and the Division of Independent Police Review. The difficult soul-searching and introspection that this city and its police bureau have had to undergo during the course of the Department of Justice investigation pointed to the fact that citizens of Portland, whether or not they are from communities of color or unfortunate victims of mental or psychological limitations, deserve to know that there are robust and transparent oversight and accountability standards for the operation of the police bureau. We look to the city charter and its agents, most notably the Portland Police Bureau, to serve as a shield from harm and not a conduit of it. It is for this reason that the Urban League fully endorses the recommendations, but most specifically, we support authorizing the Independent Police Review Division to directly question Police Bureau employees and compel their testimony, and authorizing citizen review committee members to serve on police review boards in use of force cases. Our support of these recommendations is in no way meant to communicate a blanket indictment of all those officers who wear the uniform of the Portland Police Bureau. I know too many of them who have entered this work with the highest commitment to serve the common good, and who travel that path with integrity and general concern every day. I feel equally compelled to support these changes on their behalf so that outliers from their ranks who fail to carry out their responsibility with the level of professionalism and competence that they are entrusted to do are shown to be the exception rather than the rule. I would like to close by stating that in no way do these recommendations address the depth and breadth of concerns felt by many in our community and this city, and I'm sure you will hear clear illustrations of that in a few minutes. But I'm equally confident that they will also trigger resistance within certain elements of the police bureau as well. But I believe that this is a journey that this city, this police bureau, and this council must take. And the longest journey always begins with the first step. And I encourage you to take that step today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Jan Friedman. I'm a staff attorney. I'm not actually the director, but I am a staff attorney with Disability Rights Oregon. And we're the protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities in our state. We also have been part of advisory boards having to do with Portland Police Bureau since 1999 and are part of Albina Ministerial Alliance. As such, we welcome a professional police review board that conducts investigations that are truly independent and thorough. And in basic, well, as you're aware, the U.S. Department of Justice found that as to the Portland Police Bureau, there was reasonable cause to believe that there is a pattern or practice of unnecessary or excessive uses of force in certain encounters between police officers and persons with or perceived to have mental illness. So real change is needed. We know that. We've seen the the director present the U.S. DOJ findings, but I think we need to make changes that meet the DOJ findings and exceed that for our people with disabilities in our community. This is a good start. The basic principles behind what the auditor's office is proposing are very important, but it is that it's a start, and there needs to be additional changes for people with disabilities to be able to feel safe and for there to be that sort of trust in our community that we want to regain. We definitely support the IPR code change that allows IPR to conduct an independent investigation, that they can directly question police officers and compel their testimony without going through the Portland Police Bureau Internal Affairs Division to do that. You saw the director explain what the current process is, and it doesn't make sense because it doesn't allow the independent police review to actually do an investigation. If they don't have access to the police officer, they're not able to do their independent investigation, and we're not able to have the accountability of our police officers that we need. We also support the implementation of a discipline guide as a tool for Portland Police Bureau managers. It sounded like the guide was going to be developed by the Bureau with IPR's help. It seems that IPR should take the lead in that guide, and the Bureau should be helping out in terms of what discipline there would be. It could be something like the criminal sentencing guidelines, where you look at the person's past history and you look at the severity of the misconduct and you come up with something that's going to be about the same if you have the same facts or similar facts before you, instead of it being potentially more random or unfair or not consistent. Hopefully that sort of guideline might also help the Portland Police Association when they're in arbitration to not drop discipline or lighten up on discipline or change the discipline of Portland police officers. If there was something that was consistent that was being used throughout for Portland police officers, that would be very important. And we do support the 180 days to do the administrative investigation. Evidence is likely to disappear or fade as time goes on. The public doesn't have access to the misconduct and what's happening with that hearing, but there definitely should be something that allows like a good cause exception for if it would make it such that the person was not going to be disciplined or something different was going to happen, that there would be an exception to that 180 days.
And we have, I don't mean to interrupt, but we have a proposal for an exception, which essentially is you write a letter. If you go, so what would be your good cause exception? How would you structure that?
Well, basically, a person would have to present enough evidence to show that this is something that needs to take more time. They need to show why it's taking more time, give some information about why it's different than the typical case that can be completed within 180 days, and treat it in that way. Also, if it's something that actually would defeat the purpose of police accountability, that obviously has to be taken into account. And basically what a disability rights organ is in favor of these reforms. If the three additional IPR investigators can have some new authority to do their investigation so that they are independent and thorough, that's going to enhance the accountability of our police officers, enhance our police force, and enhance the relationship between the citizens of our community and the Portland Police Bureau.
Thank you. Thanks. Casey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hills and members of the City Council. My name is Casey Chama. For the record, I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. a statewide immigrant and refugee rights organization based in North Portland. First of all, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. I want to say a couple comments about this proposal in front of you. This proposal in front of you is actually a good set for first steps toward true police reform in Portland, but they don't go far enough to make the Portland Police Bureau truly accountable to the community. Although CIO supports today's ordinance, we have viewed this as the beginning of the discussion, not the end. Our first concern is the process. Involve the process, this code changes. After a series of the city-driven changes in 2010, an oversight work group was created and made 41 recommendations to the city. Only few of those have been pursued full, including just one to today's code changes. Secondly, the move to require investigators to complete 180 days, it sounds in theory good. I know that we have a lively discussion this earlier. But the proposal contains no provision for safety fall. If an investigation takes longer for some reason, there is a significant chance that the police policy as written will lead internal affairs simply washing their hands of a difficult or time-consuming investigations. Most notably of the changes to today's package is one which will allow IPR staff to compel officers to testimony without going to the PPB's Internal Affairs Division. This is important change which we enthusiastically support. We ask in addition that IPR commit to using this power to investigate highly profile cases. We remain concerned that the IPR's oversight and accountability arm, the Citizen Review Commission, lacks the ability to direct IPR or PPP internal affairs to continue the investigation. A change suggested by the community and the U.S. Department of Justice in their recent settlement with the city. Expanding the CRC to 11 members is an important step. But those members should be empowered to fulfill their duties. In addition, the city should work to ensure that the CIRC members is truly diverse. It's not now representative of our changing face of Portland. We are also challenged by the changes with the city that has not brought forward in this proposal. As many of our colleagues in Portland Cab Watch and Albina Ministerial Alliance have noted, the reasonable person standard review which CRC issues is problematic and confusing, and it has prevented victims of the police misconduct from obtaining a just result. Portland should adopt a preponderance of evidence standard of the CRC to provide for more consistent appeals process and encourage true civilian oversight of our police bureau. In conclusion, as I said before, CIO supports the changes in front of you. We are glad to see that the city takes steps toward the real reform and accountability in Portland Police Bureau. At the same time, there is a far more that we as a community can achieve. Recommendations which we are outlined years ago, not including as a part of this reform. We must do more, and we must do it now, truly to promote justice for all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on this panel? Thank you all. Appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, let's give the chief and Captain Famous a chance to come up and respond to the auditor's proposal and answer any questions, and then we'll open it up for public testimony after that. Good
Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. I appreciate the opportunity to provide my perspective on the proposed changes before you today. And as you contemplate these changes, I believe it's important to have a brief overview of our current system. And I know Constantine provided some of that, but Captain Famous is here and would like to take a few minutes just to talk about how our discipline process works right now so that you can have, as we talk about these changes, you have a really complete understanding of the different components of it.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. As the Chief said, my name is Dave Famous. I'm the Captain of the Professional Standards Division, and I'm in charge of Internal Affairs. We'll provide a brief overview of, I think, where we're at, and we'll provide some detail, and then I'll give it back over to the Chief. So this first slide, I think, we're looking back over a 10-year period, if you will, ish, of citizen complaints that have been received from 2000 through 2012. So I'd offer that, you know, what we're seeing there really is a downward trend, a little spike there prior to my arrival, but we see a real downward trend, I think, in citizen complaints coming in. The next slide you'll see here is for force complaints received 2004-2012. Again, we see a significant downward trend in force complaints coming in. And then the question becomes, well, what is a force complaint? All force incidents, we can see by the numbers, again, are showing a downward trend from the statistics that I have from 2008.
And these are in cases in which force was used, whether there was a complaint or not, right?
Correct. It's all force incidents. Thank you, sir. And, you know, at the bottom of the slide there, it includes pointing of a firearm, takedowns, use of taser, use of hands and feet, the hobble, control holds, pepper spray, the less lethal beanbag shotgun, and then the ASP baton. So I think we see a downward trend in the use of force in all these categories. And as we move, what we'd like to do is provide just, if we can, a brief example of, again, I think Director Sevier touched on the complaint process. We'd like to walk you through a sustained complaint example. It's just one allegation. It's the allegation is sustained, and it's going to lead to discipline. So we'll just kind of walk you through that process. So as the director noted, the first stage in the process, a citizen files a complaint with IPR. IPR does the initial intake, and they have the opportunity at that time to either dismiss a complaint, recommend it for mediation. In this scenario, they're sending it to Internal Affairs for a formal administrative investigation with one allegation. Okay, next complaint. Next slide. So we have IPR reviews. Oh, I'm sorry. I got a little ahead of myself. So IPR sends the complaint to Internal Affairs. Internal Affairs conducts the investigation. Prior to that investigation being complete, IPR will review and approve that investigation prior to it being sent out for the commander or captain for findings. Once the case is at findings in this scenario, the commander makes the determination of sustained. It's one allegation. That finding is then reviewed by that commander's assistant chief, who agrees in this case or could controvert, but we're not really controverting sustained here typically. So the assistant chief reviews the finding. After he or she has approved that, it goes to IPR and IA review the finding concurrently. It's a sustained violation. The commander is recommending discipline, so it's going to go to a police review board. And again, Director Sevier touched on the fact that a police review board hears cases where proposed discipline is suspension, demotion, or termination. Here's all cases where the finding may be controverted. In other words, if a commander recommends it's exonerated, the IPR director or professional standards captain can disagree with that, can controvert that and send it to a board. The police review boards also hear all cases of deadly force in custody death, and hears cases in which use of force results in hospitalization. Now, the voting members that are on the police review board include typically one citizen, the IPR director, one peer, the peers or the officer's assistant chief, and the officer's commander. So that's five voting members. We also have quite a few advisory members, and I think it's important to mention those folks that are in the room on when the board convenes. We have a representative from the Bureau of Human Resources, the City Attorney's Office, the Captain of Professional Standards, the Captain of the Training Division, the Review Board Coordinator, a representative from the Commissioner's Office, and an additional branch chief who does not supervise that particular member. So we have those voting members. So the PR Police Review Board in this scenario concurs. It's a sustained violation. They also concur that discipline, with the discipline say it's time off. So at that point, the independent facilitator who manages this event will craft a letter to the chief of police documenting the police review board's recommendation, say in this case it's sustained and there's discipline. At that point, professional standards is advised because we write a letter that is directly to the complainant explaining the commander, how the commander made the decision. So in this scenario, it's sustained, so we acknowledge that, how that determination was made. We also acknowledge the likelihood of discipline, but we adhere to state law, which does not allow us the ability to talk about the specific discipline that was meted out in our determination with the city attorney's office. So we rely on state law. So we let the complainant know it's sustained, there's discipline, and that's the end of that period. At that point, the chief writes his proposed finding and discipline letter to the member, which is reviewed by the city attorney.
And I also will add the mayor or police commissioner signs and reviews that, and the mayor has a representative or will attend the police review board as well.
And so the member has the opportunity for due process mitigation hearing. In this case, say the officer elects to have that. That due process mitigation hearing is with the chief of police. In the mitigation hearing, that includes the chief of police, the employee's commander, employee's assistant chief, representative from BHR, professional standards, and a representative from the mayor's office. Obviously, it includes a union representative of the affected member. So the officer has the time to present his or her case to the chief. Once that's concluded, the chief crafts, with the city attorney, a final letter of discipline signed by the chief and the mayor. So that kind of gets us through just one allegation. It is sustained. It's going to discipline. So that moves us to the next slide.
So you can see from what Dave is talking about, our discipline process is very complex with a lot of oversight from IPR, independent citizen participation in the PRB, as well as the mayor's representative. And it is a very complex and long process. And that will come into play as we get into the 180
one
days.
Question about the due process hearing. Because I'm familiar with that in a different context with the Parks Bureau. And it's an opportunity for the employee to provide some additional information, mitigation, question the proposed punishment. Can the officer present evidence and witnesses at that proceeding?
They can provide us clarifying or mitigating information. They're not allowed to have witnesses present. Their union representative is there. The member can provide clarifying information about and part of the discipline process. It's their first opportunity to speak to me and the mayor or the mayor's representative directly about the issues.
And typically, do you get written submissions on that?
No. Typically, the member presents along with their union representative.
And if the officer is acknowledging some error in judgment or mistake, mm-hmm. but this is also the opportunity to argue for a lesser sanction?
They will provide mitigating information, correct. And often that is of a personal nature or may go to why they were engaged in the misconduct.
So what we have here is our chart on the 180-day timeline. I think that what you can see just at first glance at the chart is that the Bureau has developed what we believe is a sound structure to meet the 180-day requirement in most cases. But again, this is on paper, and this is assuming that everybody meets their timeline along the way. So I kind of walk you through from the top to bottom what this really means. Is the Bureau initiated case, that's a case with a no police review board. This first one, there's, say, the officer is exonerated, the assistant chief, the IPR director, and the captain of internal affairs all agree. There's no, and it's done. So that we show that track, exonerated, everybody agrees, Bureau initiated case, being able to be complete in 123 days. So when we move to a Bureau-initiated case with a police review board and includes the chief of police findings, again, it's the IA investigation includes the findings. We have the police review board, which we give 30 days for. We have the administrative process. Everybody's agreeing. Nobody's controverting. This includes chief's finding. It's a serious case. Perhaps it's the PRB has made a recommendation, but it takes that period for the chief of police to review. We show that coming in at 174 days. The next number three provides us an example of an officer-involved shooting or in custody death administrative investigation. The investigation piece here, if you may, that includes internal affairs. It includes the detective criminal investigation, and it includes the training division analysis in that time period. In order for a commander to make or him or her to come to a finding on that issue, they need all those components. So the commander makes a finding. It goes to police review board. There's administrative process, the chief's findings. Say the finding is in policy. And that brings us to about 177 days, so we're close there. Now, citizen-initiated case. That's, again, now we're having the time frame where we have the IPR intake process, we have the IA investigation findings, administrative, again, the IA captain, the IPR director, and the assistant chief all agree. But here it's a citizen-initiated case. So what Internal Affairs does is crafts a letter to the citizen explaining how the commander came to their determination, their finding. And then IPR actually puts a cover letter on that. IPR has to approve the content of our letter. Once IPR approves that, that document is sent to the citizen. And the citizen has a 30-day, that CRC appeal window is 30 days, so they have 30 days to decide whether or not they want to file an appeal. Say in this model, the 30-day window goes by, there's no appeal requested, and so we're done. We're looking at 181 days. So that's
quite close. Can someone waive that appeal opportunity in writing earlier than 30 days?
You know, you'd have to ask the IPR director a question for that, but typically I believe the process is that we afford that 30-day window. If someone were to contact IPR, and, you know, that would be a question for the director. So the next example we have is a citizen-initiated case with a citizen review board appeal. So we have the IPR intake, the IA investigation findings. We have the 30-day appeal window, so they can file that appeal. Then we have the actual CRC appeal. And there's two components to that. Under the current code, there's the case file review hearing, which we allow 30 days, if I'm not mistaken, and then 30 days for the actual appeal. So that's an extra 60 days there on that one. And we're moving that up now to 241 days.
And these are, again, best case scenarios.
That's if everybody meets their timeline. So then we move to a citizen-initiated case that includes a police review board and a CRC appeal window of 30 days. The appeal's not filed. The chief makes his findings, and that comes in at about 232 days if everybody's meeting their timelines. And then the last example here we have is a citizen-initiated case with a police review board and a full CRC appeal. So we have all of the components, the IA investigation, the findings, the police review board, which we give about 30 days for, the CRC appeal window is 30 days, and that's CRC actual case file review and appeal hearing. So on that model, you can see really under the current code, we're talking about 90 days for CRC if we're having an appeal, a full appeal. So that would be, that in itself is half of the 180 days, and that brings us to 278 days. On that note, there's been some discussion, and Chief, if you don't mind, I'll just kind of punch this in here right now. On January 1 of 2013, Chief Reese directed Internal Affairs to complete all administrative investigations within 180 days. And if that doesn't happen, he wants in writing an explanation why. And we've heard the discussion what the DOJ is required. So in the spirit of the DOJ agreement, I'm doing that. I'm currently doing that. So far in 2013, I know cases are closing probably as I speak administratively. But right now, I had the opportunity to review six administrative investigations that have closed in 2013. Two out of the six are officer-involved shootings. Four out of the six exceeded the 180 days. Interestingly enough, the average days for these six, including the ones that went outside, is 194 days. So I would offer up that we're making progress. There are reasons why, but in each of these cases, I've authored a memo directly to Chief Reese explaining, okay, this case went outside the 180 days, and here's why. I've contacted the folks that own that piece of the investigation. Here's what the response was, and here's an action plan to try to do better in the future.
And again, as we enter into the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, those memos will be forwarded to the Department of Justice outlining specifically why in those cases we were outside the 180 days. And if I can just add to that, as part of that robust discussion we had with the Department of Justice, we all realized that the 180 days was an aspirational goal and that there were reasons why, good reasons why, the Police Bureau and IPR would fall outside that. Sometimes there are cases where there are complications from criminal investigations. We don't want to proceed. The district attorney may ask us not to proceed immediately with a internal affairs process, complete it, because it may complicate the criminal prosecution. We had that in the Parikh Singh shooting, where one of our officers was shot. The person that shot the officer, of course, was facing serious charges. The DA asked us not to proceed with certain aspects of the discipline process. You know, we review every officer-involved shooting, not to review that completely until they were sure that they had all of the criminal pieces lined up.
And I would just briefly add to that that the relationship between Internal Affairs, the Independent Police Review Division, and the Detective Division, as we move through these very complex and sensitive investigations, has been, I think it's been very cooperative. We've worked, we've tried to make common sense decisions. DOJ is directed that we conduct concurrent criminal and administrative investigations. So we need to work as what serves the city in the most productive way and thorough and complete and unbiased way. And I think over time, I've worked with three IPR directors. And I can certainly say that all three We may not have always agreed, but Internal Affairs has appreciated the insight and the ability to help make our structures evolve over time to the best that we have the ability to do so. So with that, and this last slide, it does show a downward trend in Internal Affairs administrative cases. We can look back in 2002, where we have 86, and now in 12, you know, we're looking at 40. So it's situational, but I think overall, and again, I can't account for that one dip there, but overall, I think we see a downward trend in administrative investigations. And I think that mirrors what we have. Citizen complaints are down, use of force is down. And so it's no real surprise, I think, that administrative investigations show a downward trend as well.
So I think, as you can see from the overview, there are a number of really significant areas of improvement that the Police Bureau and IPR have made. And when you look at those key performance measurements, we're doing good work. You can also see from the overview that our discipline process is very complicated and complex. And I want to also highlight that we have made numerous changes to the Police Review Board and our discipline policies during the past few years. These changes are still underway, and I recommend giving the Bureau time to adapt and incorporate these changes before making additional revisions that are not part of the DOJ settlement. In regards to the proposed IPR and PRB changes, there are many areas of agreement between the Police Bureau, IPR, and the Department of Justice. These include adding citizen review committee members to our PRB. I think that's a positive step forward and will allow the CRC to see the really deliberate and thoughtful process that we undertake as part of the PRB. I also believe that outlining how the selection process of those CRC members is important, and we are in agreement with that. Strengthening investigations of excessive force and providing public reports on the outcomes of police review boards, and we've been doing that for quite a while now. I do have concerns about some of the recommended IPR and PRB changes, and the mayor has asked me to refer to specific language of the proposed ordinance as I go through this. So I'll be very specific about the pages and the numbers that we're looking at. So the definition on page 3 of the proposed changes, the definition of a member is being changed to include our non-sworn managers if they supervise sworn employees. This opens a new area of IPR authority without a specific identified issue. These are typically non-represented high-level managers. Bringing them under the IPR umbrella will actually slow down investigations. As you've seen with members, we have very complex, complicated investigations into non-sworn performance issues and provide those employees, again, these are non-represented employees, with employment rights that they do not currently have. Page 6 and page 23 refer to, I think, one of the biggest issues for the Police Bureau, and that's compelling the testimony, giving IPR the ability to compel the testimony of Bureau employees. This will likely be viewed as a mandatory subject of bargaining, and I have concerns about how we implement that part of the this section of it and the unintended consequences of doing so. There are issues involving Garrity and employee civil rights that still need to be resolved. The Bureau is not aware of any problems with the current system where IPR is a part of the investigation and participates meaningfully in the questioning of Bureau members. And Dave will speak specific to that.
I think that authorizing the ability to compel is more restricted than what is outlined in the DOJ settlement agreement. The word compel is not in there. The recommendation to compel is not in there. Certainly, I understand that the recommendation for a meaningful, independent investigation is in there. And I would offer up that IPR currently has the ability to do that and actually has done that. I wasn't a part of the process in 2010 where they developed this situation where if IPR conducts an investigation, we need an IA liaison in the interview to, if the IPR investigator wants to ask a question, that they have to go through the IA liaison. I tried doing that in my head once. I just couldn't do it. It was, I'm trying to imagine an interview being conducted in that manner. So at the direction, at my direction, the IA liaison provides the admonishment, the order to answer questions fully and truthfully. The fact that, say, in the scenario could be that Constantine Sevier, Director Constantine Sevier, is in charge in the investigation, and under the authority of Captain Famous, delegated the authority from the Chief of Police, I'm ordering you to answer all your questions fully and truthfully, or you may be subject to discipline up to and including dismissal. So that's the way it works. The last investigation, independent investigation that occurred, that's exactly what happened. My IA investigator gave the admonishment and then, for lack of better terms, got out of the way. And the IPR investigator asked the questions of those involved directly. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a common sense way to conduct that investigation, that nuance from my investigator, and he did that at my direction. And if I'm outside of the code there, then I had concerns about that.
Well, can I just address one question on that, Chief, to you? The IPR director at page 14 of the PowerPoint said he had vetted this issue with the city attorney's office, and they agreed this was not a mandatory subject of bargaining. In your testimony, you say it's most likely a mandatory subject of bargaining. So I don't, not that I want to have a full discussion here of the dueling legal opinions, but at some point the council needs to know whether it is or isn't and what the implications are. And I'm concerned that apparently we've got conflicting legal advice on what is a very important point, because if we go down a path that is later determined to be a subject of mandatory subject of bargaining, it means that any action we take is subject to a ULP, and the action that the council wants to see implemented is thwarted. So I just want to be clear that this is not just a technical legal issue. This
Correct.
Is goes to the heart of whether we have the authority to mandate this or whether we're required to bargain. But at this point, we've had a presentation this afternoon with dueling legal opinions. And Mayor, I don't quite know how to resolve that.
Well, you both.
Again, the officers have a Bill of Rights that's incorporated into the collective bargaining agreement. The admonishment that we give them, as Dave said, they're acting under my authority. The investigator is ordering the officer to speak. It provides guarantee protection to the officers, and the employee's civil rights are protected, but it allows us to get at the heart of the matter and direct the employee to answer those questions.
And so, Chief, I want to be very clear. I'm not arguing the policy question. I mean,
no,
we're going to have lots of testimony from people, and we're going to hear presumably both sides of that. I'm just arguing the threshold question about whether we can or can't mandate this. And I want to be clear about the scope of my authority, because I don't want the public to be misled about whether we can and can't do something. So this is, to me, a threshold question of some significance.
And again, the important point that Dave mentioned is that the current system is working very well. We have IPR able to conduct independent investigations, and they're able to participate meaningfully in our investigations. And if they have questions, they get answered. On page 13, number B, it mentions that the IPR director will provide, when they do an independent investigation, will provide the chief and IED commander with a report of the investigation and the RU manager for preparation of the findings and proposed discipline. This is probably a typo, but the language "proposed discipline" should be struck, as RU managers do not make discipline recommendations. Those actually come out of the police review board. So once the review board has made a sustained recommendation, then they decide on appropriate discipline.
I'm sorry, this is page 13.
Yeah, it's letter B. And it is probably a typo, I don't know, but again, the RU managers do not put forward proposed discipline as part of their recommended findings. On page 12B and page 15, section 4, this is a, and Constantine didn't discuss it in his review of the proposed changes, but this edit fundamentally alters why IPR should be conducting independent investigations. The current language makes it clear that IPR needs to make a determination that the Internal Affairs Division has not done an adequate job. This determination provides me and the police commissioner with important information, critical information in my mind, that points out a potential problem with our internal affairs division. If we are not able to conduct adequate investigations, I need to know that, and the police commissioner needs to know it. It allows for accountability both by the police bureau and IPR. The current language also prevents the perception by our employees that the discipline process has become unfair. So again, there has to be a determination made at the front end that that internal affairs is not capable of conducting an investigation due to some perceived issue or inadequacy. This fundamentally alters how IPR is conducting independent investigations. On page, and Dave, jump in if you have any.
Well, I'd also add is that there's no identified threshold. In other words, the IPR director has the complete authority to initiate an investigation, period. That's a shift. Scenario could be an officer-involved shooting with administrative, concurrent administrative and criminal investigation. The IPR director would have the authority to initiate that administrative investigation when he or she determines it's necessary. It could be prior to 48 hours, could be any time. There's no consequence here. I would offer up that the Department of Justice, I met with officials from the Department of Justice and discussed administrative investigations and discussed the current state of affairs and quality of investigations. And not one attorney, no one from the United States government told me or questioned the quality of internal affairs investigations. It has evolved over time. I can tell you our world has really evolved from 2005, 2007 to where we are today. And I think that that's why, but I think that we need to make sure that we have safeguards in place to protect investigative matters that are not only serious for the process, but for the community as well.
And can I interrupt just a moment? I appreciate this, and these in-depth details are definitely what I need to see, and I'd like to see this in writing. I'm sure you have it, and you're going to submit it to us. Mayor, in light of the time and the fact that we're going to get many more concerns from citizens, could we agree in principle that we're probably going to continue this hearing? So if you could give, I'd like to get a personal briefing from you on your concerns in the interim before the next hearing, and maybe we could get to citizen testimony.
So complete, if you can, go run through the remaining provisions, Chief, that you're concerned about, and then obviously we do want you to follow up with a written document.
And to add what Dave just said, when OIR reviewed our officer-involved shooting investigations, which are the most important investigations we do, they said that the Portland Police Bureau is the gold standard, that they are using our model with other agencies and recommending that. Page 24, section 3.21.230, again, this is a big issue for IPR and for the Police Bureau and CRC. All administrative investigations shall be completed in 180 days. I see this is a problem for us. Currently, our guidelines are outside that. And as you saw from the timeline, we are making progress towards this aspirational goal, but still there is work to be done by IPR, IAD, and CRC. This proposed language is inflexible. It doesn't take into account that discipline cases can be complicated by criminal matters and litigation that lengthen that timeline. Putting this bright line into an ordinance may have an adverse impact on the city's position in arbitration or litigation, and provide labor with just cause arguments if we impose discipline when investigation has gone over those 180 days. Specific to the PRB changes, and we are almost done, page 7, again, this is an issue for the Police Bureau and for me personally. Says the chief shall provide a written explanation to the police commissioner, including the reasons for the chief's finding of fact and the factors used in the discipline determination. As you've heard from Dave, the due process piece includes the mayor or the mayor's representative. So I'm writing a letter to someone who's been there and has independent representation. The employee during these due process hearings often provides personal mitigating information. It can be medical issues, it can be personal nature, the death of a child or a spouse, and I think we have a responsibility and a duty to keep that information confidential. I believe it will also have a chilling impact on employees providing that information if they know that I'm going to write it in a memorandum that may become public at a later date, and it may again be used by the employee against the city in arbitration or litigation. It'll be discoverable, and be if we discipline employees out of that, it may become part of the record. Page 8, section 1F, the chief's proposed and final discipline for the member will become public. And again, this is, I think, I want to hear from BHR and the city attorney clear guidance on this, but I believe it violates our current collective bargaining agreements with PPA and PPCOA that the city and city policies not to embarrass the employee as part of the discipline process. Page 8, section 1 and 2, the Bureau shall include the names of involved officers and witnesses to officer-involved shootings. Again, we do provide the names of officers who are involved in these encounters. We, in police reports, we may put forward the names of witnesses, but it may have a chilling impact on witnesses coming forward knowing that the police bureau is going to, in a public document, put their names there. In closing, I want to say that we're all in agreement that we want a citizen complaint system that helps to build and maintain the community's trust in their police officers. We want a system that works for the Bureau members as well, so that we do not end up in an adversarial process where discipline decisions are perceived as unfair and ultimately not sustained in arbitration. The Bureau agrees with many of the recommended changes, such as adding CRC members to the Police Review Board, but respectfully disagrees with the changes that fundamentally alter the role of IPR in conducting independent investigations, changes to the due process hearing, having IPR compel officer testimony, or putting into an ordinance timelines that are aspirational goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Further questions for the chief or Captain Famous now? Obviously, we'll have a chance for further council dialogue, both individually and at the continued hearing. But
actually, Chief, I do want to ask you about the issue of not writing down the reason for an alternate decision. I mean, how much I can understand that people want to say, here's a mitigating factor in a personal life, and you might want to act on that. But this is a public process. And the idea that these decisions, well, I mean, it's a process that's being conducted by the public, by the government. And the idea mm-hmm. that people will see that the decisions will be made by virtue of, you know, Greg says that he's having a rough time, and the chief says, okay, we're gonna let this go because you're having a rough time, and there's no written record of why that was the decision. But I don't think that that idea inspires public confidence. I mean, after all, in a criminal proceeding, a defendant can't go off separately with the jury and the judge and say, here's why I'm having a rough time, and there's no record of that, and they get let off.
Well, again, the mayor and the police chief are responsible for discipline for the police bureau, as you are for the bureaus that you supervise, and that is accountability. I believe it will have a chilling impact on employees bringing information forward if they know that that could end up in a written document that is discoverable. It does put us at risk in arbitration if we have those written documents come out in arbitration and litigation. There is a potential for us to lose in arbitration.
I don't want to go deep into this, but there are also federal and state laws which prohibit us from disclosing certain medical conditions and certain information that may be shared in mitigation, but which otherwise is protected. And again, I'm not the lawyer on this or the expert, but it would seem to me you could work around that by talking about general categories of information without violating any privacy interests. But there might be a situation where someone wants to disclose something which is medically sensitive or otherwise is covered. And in those cases, Steve, even in the public setting, there are protections so that people are not compelled to disclose a medical condition or something else. And if there would certainly be situations where that information would be embarrassing to the person if it was also a family member or some diagnosis that were not otherwise allowed to disclose to the public.
But if the law would protect disclosure in those cases anyway, What's wrong with requiring the explanation to be written down to sort of force the chief to go through the exercise of writing down, instead of having it be really informal and oral, just sort of going through the exercise of writing down these are the reasons?